This is Remembering Yugoslavia, the show exploring the memory of a country that no longer exists. I'm your guide, Peter Korchnak. We talk a lot about Bosnians, Croats, and Serbs on this show, slightly less about Slovenes, and a lot less about Kosovars, Macedonians, and Montenegrins. This is, of course, understandable. In 1981, former Yugoslavia's constituent nations, with their three religions, comprised some 94% of Yugoslavia's population. Its minorities made and continue to make significant, if overlooked, contributions to their country or countries. And Yugoslavia's human tapestry was quite rich. Since teenage, I've been fascinated with Jews and their faith. There was even a point in that youthful phase where, thanks to my favorite band's thematic focus, I was considering converting to Judaism and also writing surrealist poetry. Neither of the two things happened. Over a decade ago, back when I lived in Portland, Oregon, I worked for a Jewish elder care organization and wrote for the community's monthly magazine. I've been tracking over the past couple of decades the emergence in my native Slovakia of memory of Jewish suffering in the Holocaust and the rise of Jewish culture in public attention. Jews in the former Yugoslavia were such a small group they barely registered in official statistics. In the 1971 census, Jews comprised 0.02% of the country's population, some 4,800 out of 20.5 million. Very roughly speaking, about 1 in 10 Yugoslav Jews lived in Sarajevo. And it is here, to the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and now, during Passover, on this episode's release date, that I want to take you today. But before we get to our story, I want to highlight another tiny minority making a significant contribution to this podcast. The listeners who put their money where their ears are and support Remembering Yugoslavia and me in making it with their generosity. Thank you, Adriana, Brandy, Dušica, Mara, Mark, and Sonia for your gifts. Your support makes this show go on. And in addition to my eternal gratitude, you also have access to this episode's bonus add-on, a full interview with one of the guests, and of course to all other bonus episodes and extended episodes, all with early access and without ads, or rather asks. Thank you. Remembering Yugoslavia relies on the individual support of generous listeners. Join them. If the stories you hear on this podcast resonate with you in some way, if they enrich your life or you learn something from them, be like Adriana, Brandy, Dušica, Mara, Mark, and Sonia, and many others, and make a contribution now to support the show. Go to rememberingyugoslavia.com/donate or follow the link in your podcast listening app. Whether you choose Patreon or PayPal or a paid subscription to the podcast, every little bit helps. To tell the story of Sarajevo Jews, we have to go beyond remembering Yugoslavia, all the way to remembering the Reconquista.
In Bosnia in particular, there were two branches of Judaism, the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim. And the Sephardim came to Bosnia in the 15th, 16th centuries after the expulsion from Spain.
Francine Friedman is Emerita Professor of Political Science at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. Aside from writing numerous articles on ethnic relations in the Balkans, she's the author of The Bosnian Muslims, Denial of a Nation, Bosnia and Herzegovina, A Polity on the Brink, and just last year, Like Salt for Bread, The Jews of Bosnia and Herzegovina.
They came welcomed, so the story goes, welcomed by the Ottoman Sultan, who made a place for them in his empire. There were already Jews, of course, in the Ottoman Empire, but this wave of Jews that came from Spain and Portugal were particularly valuable to the empire and were encouraged to go not to the capital city of Constantinople, Istanbul, but were encouraged to go into the interior and make livings there. And indeed, that's what they did. And that's where we got some of the people who came to Sarajevo, to Tuzla, to surrounding communities. We got the Ashkenazim mostly when the Austro-Hungarian Empire occupied and then annexed Bosnia and Herzegovina in the late 19th century. Up until right before World War II, these two groups, the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim, had, shall we say, tolerant relations. They mingled somewhat, but not a lot.
Before World War II, one in five of 60,000 Sarajevo residents was Jewish. World War II brought catastrophe on all Jews, and those in Bosnia were no exception.
In the Holocaust, the Bosnian Jews suffered tremendously. Out of something like 14,000 Jews before World War II, perhaps 1,500 made it through the Holocaust in various ways. Some of them hid, some of them escaped. Most of those who survived the Holocaust did so by joining the partisans, the communist-led partisans who took to the woods and were one of the groups that resisted the fascists. Now, when I say the fascists, you know, we're talking about the Germans and the local fascists. Bosnia and Herzegovina had been swallowed whole by Croatia, which was ruled by the Ustasha, which were the local fascists, local regional fascists. They had a significantly anti-Serbian bent, but they also had an anti-Jewish bent or anti-Semitic bent, and they were the ones, along with the Germans, but they were the ones that killed most of the Bosnian Jews. And most of the Bosnian Jews were killed in Jasenovac, which was a system of extermination camps. Now, I mentioned that some of the Jews were able to escape to the partisans, not a whole heck of a lot, because the Germans and the fascists swooped in very quickly and decimated the Bosnian Jewish community. The partisan situation is very interesting. Even though there were very few Jews, there were several Jews who distinguished themselves during World War II to the point where they were considered heroes of the war.
The most famous partisan, later politician and party official of Jewish origin, Moshe Piade, was from the Jewish community in Serbia. In Bosnia,
the most well-known was a man named Slaviša Vajner. He was born in Croatia, but spent a lot of time and education in Sarajevo as an engineer. And he was one of the major commanders in what's called the Romania region. He had songs written about him. He was larger than life. Unfortunately, he was murdered in 1942 in an ambush, but he was considered a heroic partisan.
Several other Jews distinguished themselves during the People's Liberation War. Rosa Papo, a doctor and officer in Tito's partisan army, reached in the 1970s the rank of major general in the Yugoslav People's Army. The story went that at that time, the country had more generals than Israel. Oskar Danon later became a well-respected orchestra conductor. And Nisim al-Bahari held a number of high-level party and government positions, including Minister of Labor.
And I should mention there was a camp called RAB, R-A-B, on the Italian side, or held by the Italians, and any Jews who could escape to the Italian-occupied area of Croatia, most of them lived. And those who escaped there were eventually rounded up and sent to this camp called Rab, where they were able to maintain some, it wasn't wonderful, I mean, it was still a camp, but they had some capability of leading a decent life. They lived through the Holocaust, and when Italy surrendered, there was even for about 20 days, a Jewish brigade that formed to liberate themselves from the Italians, and then they were taken into the Croatian partisan units.
One Sarajevan born on the island of Rab in 1943 was Jakub Finci, the president of the Jewish community in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Otherwise a lifelong Sarajevan, Finci was the first of his family in 350 years to be born outside of Sarajevo.
1945, all of Europe was destroyed. America was far away and was closed. State of Israel didn't exist. And not because of a famous saying that nostalgia is typical Jewish disease, but all survivors came back to Sarajevo because that was only place where they can go. They came back home here.
I spoke with Jakub Finci last May in Sarajevo at his office in the Jewish Community Center, the focal point of Jewish life in Bosnia's capital. Meanwhile,
one other group of people who made it through the war was former Yugoslav army captives or POWs who reluctantly the Germans kept some of them alive during World War II, according to the conventions of war. They and the partisans, the active partisans after World War II, along with, of course, all of the other people who had served honorably during World War II, did have a special place in socialist Yugoslavia. Some of them were actually dyed-in-the-wool communists. They believed in the communist ideology. Some of them saw no other way. If they weren't totally wedded to communism, they at least went along with the Titoist way of reestablishing Yugoslavia. And so those people who had actively participated in the war for liberation as part of the partisans did have a privileged situation after World War II. They got apartments, they got jobs, etc.
And then in 1948, almost half of the community decides to move to Israel. 1948 was a very difficult year for Yugoslavia because Yugoslavia split with the Soviet Union, and we are expecting on daily basis attack from the east. And then, especially Jews who survived once said, I'm not ready to try again, I will go to Israel. My family said, we just came back. Let's stay here for a while and Israel will stay and can wait for us. And they never went to Israel except as a tourist.
A full interview with Finci is in the bonus episode available to Patreon and other supporters. Go to rememberingyugoslavia.com/donate to get access.
The situation of the Jews in Yugoslavia was that if they wanted to practice their religion, they could modestly. The very tight communism of the first several years after World War II did not smile very benevolently on active practice of any religion, because during World War II, the various churches were very actively involved against the communists, particularly, of course, the Catholic Church, but also the Orthodox Church up in the Serbian areas was somewhat complicit. And some of the institutional Muslims, those who were favored by the ruling powers during World War II, were complicit. So after the war, these various religious institutions were actively not only hated by the population in general and the communists in particular, but they were not permitted to do much actively religiously.
According to ethnographic research he did in the late 1980s, Paul Benjamin Gordiev found that with religious activity allowed but curbed, it was Holocaust commemoration that became the symbolic foundation for a Jewish life in Yugoslavia. After the war, the Jews of Yugoslavia rebuilt their communities within the bounds of the socialist state. Leading the process were veterans of the People's Liberation Struggle and POWs. Having suffered for Yugoslavia, they stayed in Yugoslavia to rebuild. The first order of business was relief, because the surviving Jews were decimated economically as well. During this reconstruction period, the Yugoslav Jews accepted the help of American Jewish humanitarian organizations, while framing that assistance as a contribution to the Yugoslav project. Conforming with the ideology of brotherhood and unity, two groups of people killed in the war were commemorated in socialist Yugoslavia. Partisan fighters who died in combat and civilians killed by enemies, domestic and foreign. They were typically referred to as victims of fascism. Neither of the groups were identified by ethnicity or religion. Both encompassed all citizens who qualified. That is, they were assumed to be and were rarely explicitly identified as multi-ethnic and multi-faith, even though a majority were killed on ethnic grounds. The Communist Party played down the ethnic element in its push to promote brotherhood and unity. All peoples of Yugoslavia suffered equally during the war, and all emerged victorious under Tito's leadership and the party's banner. The Jews were no exception. A number of small, impromptu memorials to murdered Jews were erected in the early years after the war in some Vojvodina towns. Then, in 1952, the Federation of Jewish Communities of Yugoslavia launched a campaign to build 5 monuments to the Jewish victims of fascism and Jewish fallen fighters. The monuments were built at Jewish cemeteries in Belgrade, Novi Sad, Zagreb, Đakovo, and Sarajevo. Though cemeteries were important for the Jews themselves, public spaces like squares and parks and sites of battles were reserved for official monuments. At the same time, their unveiling was widely publicized as the events presented an opportunity for the Communist Party to demonstrate the country's uniqueness and international success. The dedication events both inserted the story of Jewish suffering into the new socialist country's larger founding myth and elevated it into a central element of what it meant to be Jewish in Yugoslavia in the post-Holocaust period. The monuments, writes Emil Kerenji in his dissertation on the subject, were as much about narrating the story of Jewish victimhood to the wider Yugoslav community and, through its commemoration, legitimating a way of being Yugoslav in a Jewish way, as they were about demarcating a specifically Jewish history that was considered necessary for the reformulation of post-Holocaust Jewishness in Yugoslavia. As much as the monuments were conceived as a physical embodiment of history of Jewish suffering during the Holocaust, they were also meant to tell the story about belonging to the new Yugoslav state project. End quote. Thusly, the Jews in Yugoslavia, Sarajevo included, could both maintain a sense of Jewishness and, by participating in its founding myth, display loyalty to socialist Yugoslavia.
The Jewish institutions were totally decimated during World War II. Most of the synagogues were either totally destroyed or used for horrible purposes, such as the synagogue that is currently the only active synagogue in Sarajevo was used as a stable for horses.
The destruction of the community's physical and institutional infrastructure proved difficult to overcome. There was only one rabbi in the entire country between 1948 and 1968, and then between 1973 and 1992, in Sarajevo. The latter rabbi of Yugoslavia, Tzadik Danon, was a decorated partisan.
So if, as a Jew, a Muslim, a Croat, a Serb, etc., you wish to pursue your religion after World War II, it had to be quietly. No major parades or public symbols of religion. If you did pursue your religion, the likelihood that you would get a good job, particularly within the state institutions, which was a large employer at that time, that was very unlikely. So the situation for the Jews during socialism was more or less the same as others, except I did hear some anecdotes that there was some kind of underground anti-Semitism. It wasn't manifested in such a way that it was totally open. There were incidents that happened to individuals, but it wasn't a state policy.
Several days after its unveiling, the Jewish monument in Zagreb was vandalized. Requesting to initiate a criminal investigation, Jewish leaders described the attack as a reactionary and subversive offense against the essential Yugoslav values of brotherhood and unity. Perpetrators or their motives were never found.
Rather than a lot of religious activity, there was more of a cultural and social focus within the Jewish institutions.
Gordiev found that, as elsewhere, particularly the second generation of post-Holocaust Jews in Yugoslavia became more secular than religious and identified with Jewishness more ethnically than religiously. While Jews were able to live according to their traditions and practice their religion, many chose to shed their identity and instead identify as Yugoslav. One adage went that only Tito and the Jews were the only true Yugoslavs. The main religious ritual of Yugoslav Jews in the socialist period was burials. In socialist Yugoslavia, writes Gordiev about the Yugoslav Jews, the dead may have lived as Serbs, Croats, Hungarians, Yugoslavs, or as communists, but they were buried as Jews.
As the grip of communism tended to lighten, so did the ability of people to express themselves in different ways grew. And Yugoslavs, unlike Czechoslovaks, I assume, were allowed to travel outside the country. They were allowed to go maybe even to Czechoslovakia, but more likely to Germany to be Gastarbeiters. In doing so, they began to meet people maybe of their own religion and to interact with the West more than I think the countries that were more tightly bound to the Soviet Union. Tito, during that time, followed his own path to socialism. And that included, as the years went by into the 50s and 60s and even 70s, reforms that allowed people to express themselves, maybe even a little bit more religiously than previously in the immediate post-World War II era. The situation of the post-World War II era also led to something else that was very interesting, and that was a good deal of intermarriage. It's not surprising because most of the Jews perished during World War II, and young people wanted to get married, and they were thrown together, not on a religious basis, but on a, you know, citizen or civic basis, and they fell in love and they married.
With older generations dying out and subsequent ones intermarrying outside their group, Yugoslav Jews were much less interested in religious life than their parents or grandparents. The Yugoslav Jews shifted from an ethno-religious to a humanistic cultural community, supportive of both Israel and the Yugoslav project. They performed what Gordiev termed an experiment in secular Jewishness, which was submerged within the statewide Yugoslav experiment. In a 1985 survey conducted by the Federation of Jewish Communities of Yugoslavia, over 50% of Yugoslav Jews aged over 50 declared themselves atheists. 80% of those between 20 and 50 years of age were atheists. The Jews of Sarajevo were on average around 80% atheists across the board. The process of secularization there had started already in the interwar period.
So the 80s come, and increasingly throughout the 80s, particularly in the second half of the 80s, nationalist rhetoric kind of grips the former Yugoslavia from especially the Serbian and Croatian side. How did the Jewish community partake or not in that whole situation? How did they feel about all these forces tearing apart the country where they had been safe and sound for so long?
I have never been in a place except Jerusalem where the people loved their city so much. All of the people that I spoke with considered Sarajevo in particular, but other cities in Bosnia, and maybe Bosnia as a whole, considered it to be almost a living thing that they just loved. The reason I bring this up is because as people talked about what was happening in the late 80s, as you rightly mentioned, it was very nationalistic and there was a lot of heated rhetoric. They were mostly left out. The Jews were more or less left out of the conversation. They knew what was going on, but they didn't have a voice. They were one of the greatest victims of what happened because they had no role that they could play in mitigating the nationalist rhetoric. They weren't Serbs. They weren't Croats. They weren't Muslims. They were an ethno-religious minority that really didn't count for much when it came to that basic question of what the future of their country would be. And that's simply tragic. So what I heard from the people that I interviewed was a feeling of helplessness, of hopelessness, and of absolute, I can't think of a word right now that expresses the terrible feeling of loss of something that they loved so much. I mean, the common people loved Yugoslavia, still love Yugoslavia. And to not have any input into the future of what their beloved country would be must have been so painful. And some people that I spoke with expressed the pain and the distress and the horror of watching everything that they loved totally destroyed right before their eyes for I have to say, and this is my own editorial opinion, for nothing.
That was El Dio Alto by the Balkan Sephardic music band Shira Utfila, who kindly gave me their permission to play it for you. Find them at their website shira-utfila.com, on Facebook and Instagram, on the major music streaming and video platforms, and buy their music at Apple Music. All the links are at rememberingyugoslavia.com/podcast. The Bosnian War found the Sarajevo Jews in a unique position.
In Bosnia, especially after this last war, I hope that it was the last one, but you never know, especially in this part of the world, we have been on all three sides, so to say, because you can find Jews serving in the Bosnian army, in the Serbian army, as well as the HVO, that means Croatian army troops. We divide on some way that communities which are in the Croatian part of the country, our brothers in Zagreb will take care about them. For these parts, which is on the Serbian part of territory, people from Belgrade take care about themselves. And here we take care about ourselves and about the other citizens of Sarajevo. Before war in Sarajevo started, it was a relatively short war in Croatia. At that time, the coastal city of Dubrovnik, there is a small Jewish community, not more than 40 people, and during the siege of Dubrovnik, which lasted, comparing with Sarajevo, just 90 days, the main problem for this aging community was to provide medicines. And we used some Jewish connections and we succeeded to smuggle some medicines to them and so on. And then we sit around the table and said, this can happen also to us. What we should do? And we called all our doctors and pharmacists, asking them, please prepare lists for 1,500 people to survive 3 months under condition of the siege. And they made very huge and extensive lists of medicines, and we succeeded to buy all these medicines, some of them which missed on the U.S. market, we got from the States. And that's how we find that the war is not something which we didn't expect. For the rest of the money that still stay in the pocket, we bought some food, mainly rice, beans, flour, sugar, oil, salt, just to be able to survive. And we said, if everything is okay, we'll deliver this as a humanitarian help for the people in need. If not, then we'll use it. And then the war started in Bosnia. And after first 7 days of the war, the siege of Sarajevo starts. Sarajevo was absolutely closed from all sides, and it was impossible to bring anything in or take out. We sent a letter to all the members of the community asking them to extend the passports and to put the exit visa for Israel just in case. Usually, yearly, 30, 40 people is using to go to Israel to visit relatives, friends, or just for the tourism. And then suddenly, in a short period of time, 400 applications for the exit visa.
Others left the city by plane or with one of the convoys to the Croatian coast, Makarska or Split, organized by the Jewish community.
Then we said, they are bombing Sarajevo. We should save our children. This is the most important. And we organized evacuation. We arranged this with the Yugoslav army. We rented a plane from them to transfer our people from Sarajevo to Belgrade, because Belgrade was the only open airport in former Yugoslavia. In the meantime, we got invitation from different parts of the world. If you would like to save yourself, please. First offer came from Bulgaria. Bulgaria is the first country who recognized Bosnia and Herzegovina as an independent state. And they said, if you need shelters, please, we have summer camps and so on. Everything is on your disposal. We pay this transport. I have somewhere receipt. I doubt that this money enter in the budget of the army. It finished in the pockets of some of the colonels with whom we discussed, but we organized 3 evacuations by planes, and after that, 8 more by buses. We sent out more than 3,000 people, 1,000 Jews and 2,000 best friends of the Jews, Croats, Muslims, Serbs equally. Everything passed pretty well. Naturally, plane was the safest way, but after that, with the war in Bosnia, we used the road from here to the coast, to the coastal city of Split, and from Split everyone was free to go wherever they wish. And it was really pretty safe to travel on so-called Jewish convoy, because nobody attacked us. Naturally, it was difficult to cross all these checkpoints, because between Sarajevo and Split, it's a little bit more than 300 kilometers. Usually these days, you can pass this in 4 hours. For us, it took 24 hours, because it was 36 checkpoints on this road. 4 controls by 4 armies. 3 national plus UN army, UN troops. Then 6 militias. And who knows who was on the other checkpoint. On some of the checkpoints, it was a flag, and it's clear to whom they belong. But sometimes it was just a group of 5, 6 young people with the rifles and the other armament. And when they stop you, you don't know what to say and how to approach them. And then usually they say, look, lovely day today. And they said, yes, but these bloody Muslims are shooting on us. That at least you know that they are not Muslims, or these bloody Croats or these bloody Serbs, whoever. And I was several times leading these convoys. I feel a little bit like James Bond at the time, you know, traveling with a 4 set of documents. All permissions from the Bosnian government, all permission from the Serbian government, all permission from the Croatian government, and all international documents which can be useful. And then in front of each of these checkpoints, you should find the right paper. Otherwise, you can be shot on the spot. But everything finished well. Nobody was ever removed from the convoy or, God forbid, wounded or killed. And this was a huge success.
Some 500 Jews remained in Sarajevo during the siege.
I should admit that all Sarajevo was looted from inside. Around 1st of May of 1992, everything, each and every shop was looted, including pharmacies, everything except bookshops, which is strange. Nobody was running for the books at that time. A few months after that, when we lost electricity, gas, any source of energy. The books have been also looted because of the 3-4 books of Marx or Engels, you can prepare your lunch. So friend who was with me at the elementary school long time ago, he's running a shop just in front of the community. He came here and said, I saw that you are distributing medicines. If you would like to have a pharmacy, please use my shop because I'm closing anyway. So we opened the first Benevolentia Pharmacy. Benevolentia is the name of our humanitarian organization, which means goodwill on old Spanish. For the Bosnians, it's not so easy to pronounce correctly La Benevolentia, and they gave the nickname Jewish Pharmacy. And then after 2-3 months, people start to complain. You know, for us, it's very difficult to reach your pharmacies because it's necessary to cross the bridges over Mijatska. And each of these bridges was an excellent target for the sniper fire from the hill. So it's very dangerous. So we opened the second pharmacy in front of the National Theater, and it was a very good place because even today it's commercial pharmacy on the same place.
Let me just quote one woman, Jewish woman who was married to a Serb who served in the pharmacy. And you have to remember that the siege was a horrific thing, horrific. But what she said to me was, that was one of the best times of my life because we were all working together. My understanding is that 40% of the medicines that came into Sarajevo came through Jewish means, and they were helping each other. They helped their Serb, Croat, and Muslim friends. And what's really interesting about that is a city under siege for more than 1,000 days, and there was no typhus. There was no cholera. How does that happen? Well, part of the reason was that they worked together.
La Benevolencia soon opened another pharmacy near the airport. The Jewish community also operated ham radio and other communication lines and smuggled mail out of Sarajevo with voluntary couriers. Finci recounts all of these activities in much detail in the bonus episode of Remembering Yugoslavia. The bonus episode, as well as all other bonus and extended episodes, are available to all Patreon and other supporters. Go to rememberingyugoslavia.com/donate to get access. If the fact that Jewish organized convoys transporting people, medicines, and other goods in both directions were able to pass through multitudes of checkpoints and war zones without problems, consider that, for one, the Sarajevo Jewish Committee's partner was the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, a New York-based Jewish relief organization. And
I discussed this with Roger Cohen, who was a correspondent for New York Times here. He said all these three groups are afraid of international public opinion. And if the headlines read that Serbs stopped the Croatian convoys or Croats didn't allow Serbs to bring in this or that, it doesn't mean anything for the American readers. But if the headlines is they stopped the Jewish convoy, they took three Jews from the convoy, it will be very bad for the image of this group, and that's the reason why they are treated so well. Maybe yes, maybe not. But unfortunately, I think that he is right. They have been a little bit afraid that it will be bad to have a bad PR with the Jews.
The Jews, while small, a lot of the women and children were sent out, but more and more people came every day to help. Discovering a Jewish ancestor or just the will to help. This was a magnificent contribution to a city, to a country that they loved. I don't know that the Jewish contribution to helping mitigate the siege is all that well recognized anymore. It's probably pretty unpopular. But the Jewish community made a significant and pretty unselfish contribution to the well-being of their city under horrific circumstances.
Wow. una noche a lunar, yo salía a caminar, caminando y buscando donde se topa la mar, caminando y buscando donde se topa la mar. Los ojos me se abufaron de tanto mirar a la mar. Vaporecía, van y vienen letras para mí no hay. Vaporecía, van y vienen letras para mí no hay. Letras alegres recibiremos y las caras nos veremos, en un hito dormiremos, presto nos ayuntaremos, en un hito dormiremos, presto nos ayuntaremos. Mi madre, un sueño me soñaba, un sueño me soñaba, que la guerra se escapaba, un sueño me soñaba, que la guerra se escapaba.
That was Flor Jagoda with Una Noche al Lunar, One Moonlit Night, from the album Memories of Sarajevo. Born in Sarajevo as Flora Papo, she was 16 when Germany invaded Yugoslavia. She escaped from Sarajevo by train via Split. In the US, Jagoda, which was her married name and which means strawberry in Bosnian, sang Sephardic, Sevdalinka, and Ladino songs. She died in 2021. Ladino, or Judeo-Spanish, is essentially medieval Spanish that Sephardic Jews retained after their expulsion from Spain. It is a minority language in Bosnia and Herzegovina and at risk of extinction as such. Jakub Finci is one of the two last surviving speakers of Ladino in Sarajevo. After the Bosnian War, after the siege of Sarajevo,
a lot of Jews came back. A lot of Jews means 40%, which is much bigger percentage than the return of the Serbs, Croats, or even Muslims. So we changed the demographical picture of Sarajevo. Sarajevo was a really mixed town with around 50% Muslims, 30% Serbs, 15% Croats, and 5% everything else. Now we have more than 90% Muslims, less than 10% Serbs, Croats, and others altogether.
Finci has been the leader of the Sarajevo Jewish community since 1996. And since 1997, he has also participated in interfaith efforts toward post-war reconciliation with the Inter-Religious Council of Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Sarajevo and Bosnia are almost absolutely free of anti-Semitism, which is a little bit strange, especially speaking about the period of beginning of 21st century, when the rise of Semitism is visible not only in traditional places where anti-Semitism always exists, but even the United States and some countries that have been free. Here we don't have anti-Semitism, and I was always very proud to explain that we are living together with the Muslims, Christians of both denomination, and that we are going pretty well with them. And then one of my American friends told me, don't be so lucky, it doesn't mean that they like you. But these three ethnic groups are so busy hating each other, they don't have time to hate the Jews. And we are a so small group, We are not endangering them. We are not in any competition with them for businesses, political life, or whatever else. And they can tolerate you without any problem. And probably this is true, but nevertheless, the life for the Jews in Sarajevo, in Bosnia, it's pretty comfortable. You hardly can find any of the graffiti on the walls against the Jews. We have several synagogues, museum, a very old cemetery. Nothing is attacked, no signs, no overturn of the tombstones on the graveyard. The last incident happened, so to say, 12 years ago. And the police find that the children have been playing, and playing this, they overturn the monument of three tombs. But who knows? Maybe they are very strong children.
I noticed, personally, a slow but steady rise in anti-Semitic incidents through the years since the Bosnian War. And this is simply astounding. Now they're used to it, which is not a good thing. But when it first started happening, it was somewhat astounding. I personally discovered a swastika on a building. I used to walk around the city and I saw it and I drew the attention of the people at the Jewish community to that. And there have been several incidents of vandalism of the cemetery, one of the oldest cemeteries, Jewish cemeteries in Europe, is in Sarajevo, and there have been incidents of vandalism there, and other places that have a notoriety of being somehow connected to Jews. So while on the one hand there is an attempt to maintain a vibrant Jewish community to the best of their ability, on the other hand, it seems like as throughout the rest of the world, storm clouds are gathering for the Jews also in Bosnia, and it boggles the mind.
I can only speculate about the divergence of views here. One explanation might be what I experience when I travel around the former Yugoslavia. I find signs of the former countries past and present because I seek them out, or perhaps because they simply stand out to my Yugoslav-primed perception. To a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. People who live here may not notice these things because they're part of their life's fabric. Under the Dayton Peace Agreement, Bosnia and Herzegovina has a tripartite presidency with each member representing the country's main groups. A Serb from Republika Srpska, a Croat from the Croatian part of the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and a Bosniak from the Bosnian one. This means all other groups are excluded from even running for these and other federal posts.
According to the existing law, Serbs living in the Federation cannot compete, or Croats and Bosniaks living in the Republika Srpska. Altogether, it's almost 400,000 people who doesn't have a right to be candidates for this. This is more than 15% of the total population, and this is a huge problem. And I send application to the Central Electoral Commission saying, I am Jewish, living in the Federation. I would like to compete for the next election of the presidency to be candidate for the members of the presidency. And I got the answer, you are not allowed to do this because according to the Constitution and electoral law, it's a place open only for the Bosniaks and Croats from the Federation, so you cannot compete.
In 2006, Finci and Dervo Sedic, a member of Bosnia's Roma community, sued their country's government at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg to contest their exclusion.
They are, by the Dayton Peace Accords, and by the will of the current rulers, if you will, of Bosnia, they are considered other. The reason why I mentioned at the very beginning that the Jews came into Ottoman Bosnia and Serbia, etc., back in the 15th, 16th centuries, is that they have been, especially the Sephardim, have been a constituent people for a very long time, for centuries. And yet, their official position is other, which is not one of the real people, the constituent people. So, Jakob Finzi might have been a reasonable candidate. He's well known all over Bosnia. They're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to do certain things because of their status of other.
In 2009, while Finzi was Bosnia and Herzegovina's ambassador to Switzerland, the court ruled that the plaintiff's ineligibility to stand for election to parliament and the presidency violates the European Convention on Human Rights. The decision still awaits implementation.
Not only that, but post-war restitution. One of the problems in Bosnia and Herzegovina is that there has been no restitution program, not only for the Jews, but for others, but for Jews in particular, it's terribly painful. When we think about the fact that during World War II, all Jewish properties were seized by the Ustasha, by the fascists, and either given to friendly people or taken for themselves. And not only property, but furniture and clothing and jewelry and paintings and everything. Those Jews who came back from the Holocaust, who lived through the Holocaust, really didn't get much compensation for what they lost. They may have gotten an apartment, or they may have gotten back to their old apartment that they had to share with two or three other families or something like that. But the full restitution or even partial restitution was not forthcoming. So that was one problem. And they had to swallow that during the socialist era. Then comes the Bosnian War. And again, things were seized and destroyed. And not only that, but a lot of Jews left Bosnia during the war because it wasn't their fight. A good number of them stayed, but the women and the children and the elderly were sent to Israel, to the United States, to Germany, et cetera, et cetera. And some of their property was taken by the current government after the war and given to refugees from the Bosnian War. So again, they have not ever been able to reclaim property that was legally theirs since the 1900s, late 1800s even.
Jewish life in Bosnia and Herzegovina is centered in Sarajevo, where in turn it is centered on cultural activities.
Post-Bosnian War, Jewish life is constrained by demographics. They did have a wedding. They did have a couple of births. They did have even a bar mitzvah, but the numbers are very small. And as I said, the intermarriage situation is such that the Jewish community is a little bit diluted in terms of what the rest of the Jewish world considers to be Jewish. Nevertheless, they have a very active social life, which I was privileged to participate in for more than 20 years. They have a very active religious, social, and cultural life, and they also participate in the interreligious council, and they still share greetings and communication with the other religions.
We have a lot of cultural activities here. La Benevolencia is the oldest organization of such kind in the region. We started in 1892. And then during socialism, all these activities have been closed. We reopened again in just before the war in 1991. And the main goal of activities of La Benevolencia was to show the richness of Jewish culture that Jews brought with them to this country, as well as the culture that they produced here in the last 500 years. And this was pretty successful in the beginning, and then the war stopped this. During the war, we concentrated on humanitarian activities, but also working on cultural activities. Now we have, in one of our synagogues, we opened the gallery, art gallery, which is called New Temple. And the New Temple is 250 years old, but it's new comparing with the old one. We have regular exhibitions. We have Radio La Benevolencia, which is on the air once a week for 2 hours. Then we have a newspaper, Jewish Voice, which is published 4 times a year. And we have an informative bulletin, which are printing each 15 days just to inform members of the Jewish community as well as other members of the society what Jews are doing, what have been our activities, and so on. Then we are running a program called 19 at 19. Each 19 in the month at 7 o'clock in the evening, we have here concert or some promotion of some new books, some discussions of seeing the movies and discussing these movies. And all these programs are financed by the Jewish community and by donation. We have some donations even from the city council and some state institutions, so we are working pretty well. This synagogue, which is the only Ashkenazi synagogue in town, the other 5 are Sephardic synagogues, it was built in 1903. And in 1965, we refurbished the synagogue. We are cutting it in half. So a balcony where usually are the women's became the whole synagogue. And down we have a community hall, which is very acoustic and in which we are organizing this event and concerts and so on. So I think that the Jewish cultural life is visible here, and it's very easy to find what the Jews are doing, what they are supporting, with what kind of exhibitions they are organizing. And we are always working in close cooperation with the other national societies or with the other religious communities. Last year we held a conference about the life of Jews and Muslims together in the last 500 years in Bosnia, which is a very nice book. Unfortunately, it's not yet translated in English.
The more famous book that is rightly the pride of Sarajevo Jews is the Haggadah.
Haggadah is really the most valuable artifact that we have in our National Museum.
The 14th century book, which incidentally has never been owned by Bosnian Jews, contains the illuminated text of the Passover Haggadah, a text read at the Passover Seder feast. It is included in the UNESCO Memory of the World Register and is on display in the National Museum of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Check the limited viewing hours before you go.
And how it survived is really strange, because it survived expulsion from Spain. After that, it survived Inquisition in Europe. After that, it survived the First World War, the Second World War, the last war in Sarajevo, always survived. And it became some kind of symbol of Sarajevo, like a phoenix, like a bird that survived everything, yet always appear again. Each and every time when it was saved by non-Jews, by Muslims, by Christians, and it survived.
Like the Sarajevo Jews themselves. There are some 500 Jews in Sarajevo and a further 400 or so in the rest of Bosnia and Herzegovina.
The future of the Jews in Bosnia and Herzegovina is somewhat mixed in my perspective. Younger people are filtering back occasionally from the post-Bosnian War exile that they went into. And when they come back, they don't come back to any property or anything that used to belong to their families. So a lot of people just don't come back.
Times of Israel has reported that the community is assembling an archive of their artifacts, documents, photographs, and so on for a museum of Bosnian Jewish history.
The future of the Bosnian Jews, I hope for a glorious future. I dread that there may not be a glorious future for a continuing, enlarging community. I have hope in my heart, but I'm not so optimistic as I would like to be.
I am much more optimistic about the future of this podcast. Thanks to the generosity of my listeners, you, I am able to continue this work, hopefully for many more episodes to come. Please consider supporting the show and me in making it today. Visit rememberingyugoslavia.com/donate to make a contribution toward keeping Yugoslavia's memory alive. Toda. Next on Remembering Yugoslavia.
There is a lot to know about women in Yugoslav cinema. Women most typically or most frequently appear in front of the camera, but the story is always a bit more complicated than that.
Let's go to the movies. Yugoslav and post-Yugoslav cinema is a rich, if underappreciated, source of cultural insight. On the next episode of Remembering Yugoslavia, we'll talk films, and also films from the former Yugoslavia and its successors. Tune in wherever you listen to podcasts, follow to make sure you don't miss out, and subscribe to support us. That's all for this episode of Remembering Yugoslavia. Thank you for listening. Find additional information, sources, embeds, links, and a transcript of this episode at rememberingyugoslavia.com/podcast. While you're there, and before you go, take a moment to back the show and join the growing community of podcast supporters by making a gift today. Outro music courtesy of Robert Petrić, additional music courtesy of Shira Utfila. Follow them on social media and buy their music. Una Noche al Lunar by Flora Jagoda, used for educational purposes under the Fair Use Doctrine. According to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, the owner of copyright, if any, for the song is undetermined. I haven't been able to track it down either. The track Rainmaker by Petar Alargic, licensed under Creative Commons. I am Petar Korchniak. Alvermos.
I encourage your listeners, if they want to go to a city that will speak to you, that the stones will speak to you, go to Sarajevo, the Jerusalem of the Balkans.